I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The federal government is officially in a partial shutdown after the House and Senate could not agree on a stopgap spending bill to continue to fund the federal government for the next 6 weeks. Hundreds of thousands of federal workers are being furloughed, and many more will work without pay until and unless Congress can come to an agreement. While some services and programs will continue, others will be suspended. The sticking point is Republican demands in the House to make changes to the Affordable Care Act, which became law more than 3 years ago. President Obama and the Senate, controlled by the Democrats, said no. Here's the president.
You don't get to extract a ransom for doing your job, for doing what you're supposed to be doing anyway, or just because there's a law there that you don't like.
House Speaker John Boehner said this late last night.
I talked to the president earlier tonight. I'm not going to negotiate. I'm not going to negotiate. I'm not going to do this. Well, I would say to the president, this is not about me. And it's not about Republicans here in Congress. It's about fairness for the American people.
Is this any way to run a government? We're joined by James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies and Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University. And James Peterson, nice to have you back with us on
Thank
Radio
you.
Times.
Good to be here.
Also nice to have you with us. Also with us, Joe Watkins. He's a Republican strategist and political commentator, worked in the George Herbert Walker Bush White House. He has other associations, which I will talk about later on in the show. But just to get the conversation started, Joe Watkins, nice to have you back with us as well.
Delighted to be here.
And I should say, both of our guests have appeared as contributors on MSNBC. James Peterson, let me begin with you. Just how necessary was it to shut down the government?
Well, completely unnecessary to shut down the government to serve. It serves no purpose beyond the politics of this particular moment for what has increasingly become the Tea Party-controlled wing of the Republican Party, especially within the House of Representatives. I think for the American people to see this, and this is where I think the political consequences of this moment are deeply saddened to me, is that people are disconnecting based on this. Our government is broken, and this is just a really demonstrable example of that we're dysfunctional, that Congress is somehow disconnected and ultimately unrepresentative. They don't represent the people of the United States. And so a lot of people woke up this morning furious and outraged at how could we arrive at this point based upon these sort of silly political games that Congress seems to be engaged in
now. But Joe Watkins, do you see this as something that the Tea Party did to not only their party, but also to Congress and to the country?
Well, clearly, for some members, you know, all politics do happen to be local, and depending upon who you are in Congress and the district you represent, and your interest in getting reelected, you may have acted in your mind accordingly. I think it was not in the best interest of Americans for the government to shut down. It never is a good thing for the government to shut down.
It cost
billions of dollars.
Yeah, the last one cost
$1 billion. Right now, given the fragile state of our economy, it's not helpful to the economy for the government to shut down. But that being the case, there are some Republicans who felt that they had to make a statement, and that statement has caused the government to shut down, which is the end result.
Let me quote something that Byron York wrote last night, I think, for the Washington Examiner. He said there are 233 Republicans in the House. Insiders estimate that three-quarters of them, or about 175 GOP lawmakers, are willing and perhaps even eager to vote for a continuing resolution.
Of course.
If it had just been about funding the government for the next 6 weeks, this would have passed.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Well,
there are other ways, I think, to dialogue. I think James makes a great point when he says that the government is broken. That we at the present we're broken. We don't have to stay broken, but we're a bit broken right now. And there's no real dialogue going on. And even within parties, sometimes you see various wings of parties that are not in contact with the other wing. That's a challenge.
Indeed.
When
you
say all politics are local, but let's just be clear on the localities that we're talking about here, because we're essentially talking about, when you talk about the 50 or so Tea Party members in the House of Representatives, many of them are in gerrymandered districts. So these are Republican districts that will probably remain Republican, but they're competing with potential Republican primary challengers who might even outflank them, who might take the party further to the right. And I think that's where the politics, to me, seems to get even more dangerous. So it's not even about them necessarily pandering to a particular base, but fear of being primaried on the right for some of the folk who right now are some some of the most conservative, radically conservative people that are in Congress or in government at all. But there are people who are actually, there are some of these politicos are actually happy that the government is shut down because they're going to be able to take this back to those gerrymandered districts and say, hey, we shut down the federal government.
That is true. There are some districts, some congressional districts where shutting down the government is a badge of honor. And so some of those members of Congress will go to their districts and say, you know what, I helped shut it down because I wanted to make a statement about Obamacare.
If left-wing politicals did that, the armed forces would come out to put a stop to it.
But are we talking about minority rule here then?
Well, we're talking about the capacity of government to be halted by less than a majority of a party. And that's a minority party.
That's correct.
So I mean, we're talking about one house. You know, we've got the Senate and the House. We're talking about a piece of one house that's been able to shut government down.
But do you think there's something that John Boehner could have done? I mean, it seems like he was really backed into a corner.
I think John Boehner's hands were tied. I mean, you know, for him as the majority leader, he has real challenges with his conference. And keeping all the Republicans together is hard. At the end of the day, remember, you know, it's not just a matter of being a Republican or a Democrat. Every member of the House and the Senate has to be elected in his or her own district or state. And so at the end of the day, they all dance to the tune of what the voters back home think. And for John Boehner, trying to herd everybody together and get consensus has been very, very challenging. Now, this bodes well for the case I've made for years for term limits, which is to say that, you know, if we term limited folks, certainly on the House side to maybe three terms and on the Senate side to two terms, then folks would do as they did in the old days when George Washington was president. They serve for a couple of terms, two or three terms, and they go back to being whatever it is they were, a professor, a farmer, a banker, a teacher, you know, whatever it is they were, and they just do their government service. And then self-service is kind of removed from that. But self-service is so central to all this, getting reelected, that's what skews the...
I would argue we have to do that, but we also have to begin the process of ungerrymandering these districts. You know, we have a House of Representatives right now that is there in a position that's antithetical to the electorate. So there have been more votes for on the Democratic side for representatives in the House, yet Democrats don't control the House. That shows us the system is broken, and we have to ungerrymander districts. We have to actually go back throughout the states and really make these districts what they're supposed to be from a geographic standpoint, so that you get different groups of people in the same district, and that's what creates the kind of electoral diversity that you need to keep some of these politicians honest. Secondly, the money's got to come out of politics. We've got to extract money from the process. When you look at the sort of last-ditch efforts for Republican lawmakers to add in these different clauses, the medical device tax, the conscientious thing that denies access to contraceptives for women, those are basically special interest, well-lobbied policies that they try to tack on to get some kind of victory, but they're also key indicators that there's too much money in the system. If money is dictating that kind of policy injection in terms of the debate and the discourse in the 12th hour of a government shutdown, it lets us know not only the system is broken, but why it's broken.
Nobody wants to give up power and control, and that's the challenge. I mean, in a perfect world, if we just looked at it as the proper outcome for Americans, that'd be one thing, and we could probably get something done. But at the end of the day, when people have power and control, they've amassed it, they've worked hard to amass it, be it through gerrymandering or the
lobbyists or money, special interest dollars,
whatever it is, they want to keep that. And so the challenge becomes is how do we get past that? I mean, we've got a very toxic environment right now where Americans have been led to believe that if you're in the opposite party, that you can't be my friend. And we don't talk to each other either. It's gotten so mean-spirited that there's no real dialogue. For instance, with Obamacare, the attention of the law is a good thing. Why wouldn't we want to make sure that people who aren't insured get insured?
Kind of a Republican idea, wasn't it?
It is a Republican idea.
But it ought to be an American idea. You know, let's take care of the folks who are having the hardest time.
That's right.
Let's not make it a Republican or a Democrat idea. The challenge becomes is how do we then make a law that is well-intentioned do what it is we want it to do and not have consequences that are unintended?
Let me ask you, James, only because I noticed several times that the president, who has been quite public in the last week or so, kept saying, this is not about me. This is not about me. How much do you think his critics, or those people that have, in a sense, voted to shut down the government, think it's want to make
it's interesting,
about him.
Right? He's saying that, but in actuality, in some cases, it is about him. When you look at when we try to get to the very heart of the ways in which some of his political opponents are rejecting him, this is not all of his political opponents, because he's got political opponents on the left that I don't think are objecting to his policies based upon his race or what his identity is. But this Tea Party caucus that we're talking about, these are the same folks who are in and around and supportive of birtherism. These are the same folks that don't think that, and they represent constituencies that don't believe that this president is a legitimate president. So yes, in some ways it is about him. When you look at the polling around Obamacare, you change the name to Affordable Care, people feel differently about it. When you break it up and like show people the different pieces of it, they're overwhelmingly in favor. But when you call it Obamacare, there's confusion. There's what is that about? It's always, about the president.
It's always going to be about the president. It's always going to matter who it is, whether it's Bill Clinton or Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush. It's always going to end up being about the president.
But in this case,
even more so, because we have the first African American president of the United States, and so that adds even a different element to it. And I know as an African American that it does. But I would say this: the challenge for this president, who I think has done just an amazing thing to be elected president of the United States twice. Which is hard for anybody, let alone for an African American to accomplish in the 21st century. The challenge for him going forward is not to continue to do what it is he does well. He is inspirational and inspiring as a speaker, and he's a great communicator, and he has, I think, great ideas. I think the challenge for him now is the smaller game, the more important game, which is the behind the scenes game. The presidents who have been successful, the most successful, were able to get things done even though the other side was mean to them. Bill Clinton was impeached by Republicans, but he got things done. Ronald Reagan was no fan of Democrats, but he got things done. LBJ was reviled by Republicans, but he got civil rights, he got voting rights, he got fair housing done.
He muscled a lot of that.
Absolutely. And so the challenge for this president is to get past all the mean-spirited talk and to bring people together and to get things done.
If you look at this president's track record from his first inauguration through 2010 and look at the policies that came through, including Affordable Care Act, but a host of other things that he was able to achieve during that time where there wasn't the goal of just pure obstruction. You're right. Newt Gingrich and the Republicans of the 90s despised Bill Clinton because one of the things that Bill Clinton was very, very effective at was appropriating Republican policies with respect to businesses and making them look like Democratic policies. They hated that. But it didn't go to the core of Clinton's character, of the core of who he is. And I'm sorry, some of this president's opponents are about the fact that this president is a black man.
There's
and that's
no
a very
doubt about
difficult
it.
Hurdle. Difficult hurdle to overcome when you're talking about these very subtle backroom golf club, cigar-filled room negotiations that American politics requires. This president has a different impediments to those rooms.
Hold on to that thought, only because the clock is telling me we have to take a very short break. And this is just a flavor of what it's been like in the studio for the last 20 minutes, talking with James Peterson and Joe Watkins. We're talking about the partial government shutdown, the polarizing effect of our politics, and we want to hear from you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Bryn Mawr College's Creative Writing Program Reading Series supports WHYY and presents National Book Award-winning fiction writer Robert Stone in a reading open to the public at Bryn Mawr College's Thomas Great Hall on Thursday, October 3rd at 7:30 p.m. His first novel in a decade, Death of the Black-Haired Girl, will be published in November, and this is Stone's first Philadelphia-area reading from it. Details on this and on the Bryn Mawr series are available online at brynmawr.edu.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, for the subject of her sweeping new novel, Eat, Pray, Love, author Elizabeth Gilbert turns to 19th century botany.
People were making their name and their fame at it. They were undercutting each other. They were selling out their countries. It was a really exciting time.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. The symphony must embrace the world, said Gustav Mahler. And in his fourth symphony, Mahler's world is viewed through the eyes of a child. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Mahler's Symphony No. 4. tickets online or at 215-893-1999. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, Yannick Nézet-Séguin conducts Mahler's Fourth Symphony with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with James Peterson and Joe Watkins, who are currently texting as I...
Tweeting, texting.
I caught you. Joe Watkins is a Republican strategist and a political commentator, worked in the George Herbert Walker Bush White House. He serves as pastor of Philadelphia's Christ Evangelical Lutheran Church, and he's the receiver for Chester Upland School District, which is just outside of Philadelphia. James Peterson, director of Africana Studies and associate professor of English at Lehigh University. You might have seen both of our guests on TV. They are both contributors to MSNBC, and Joe Watkins also on CNBC and also on Al Jazeera. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Picking up, though, on what you both were just saying about the president, I mean, do you think if he had sort of wined and dined and schmoozed Republicans and the Republicans that have, hold on one second, who have voted against the budget so far, that we would not be having this conversation?
Well, it's not a matter just of schmoozing and whining and dining, but you do have to build relationships. Relationships do matter in Washington and everywhere, and whether no matter where you are in the United States, and certainly for a president. I made the same point on CNBC about a week or so ago, and one of the other commentators said, "Oh, well, the president is reaching out. He's, you know, his aides have reached out to senators and like." Well, I was an aide to a U.S. president, and I think I'm a decent human being, but me reaching out to a U.S. senator or his or her staff and the president reaching out are two different things. Now, what James Peterson is saying is absolutely right. The president does have some challenges. He has bigger challenges than previous presidents, but I think he's up to the task. I don't think that these are beyond him to do. He has to reach a little bit deeper in order to get this done, past some of the slights and some of the insults, some of the challenges that face him. But I think that to actually reach out to the other side and to have some strong allies on the R side of the aisle would help the country in terms of moving us forward on legislative. We don't need to shut down. We could talk about Obamacare, maybe figure out a way to make changes to it. But at the end of the day, we ought not be shutting down the government or not doing debt ceiling.
I have
much respect for you, Rev. You know this. You're one of the only folk on the other side of the aisle that I can actually sit down and have a normal conversation with, but it simply is not about that. And the reason why it's not is because when you look at this president's policies, when you look at his foreign affairs and his international policy, when you look at his economic policy, when you look at his policy with the social safety net, look at his policies across the board, affordable health care included in this, these are moderate Republican policies. His foreign affairs is moderate Republican policy. His business is robust business policy, banking policy. All of his policies, the things that he supports and he does, are things that in the immediate history Republicans have supported, if not crafted, as in the case of the Affordable Care Act. So we can talk about he's not negotiating or they're not friends, they don't play golf together, and that can be one problem, but why can't his political opponents open their eyes to the reality of the Obama administration, which is a moderate, if not moderate, right? 10 to 15 years ago, if we just back this up a little bit, you take all those policies, take, you know, the sort of doctrine around foreign affairs and international affairs, take his doctrine with respect to the big banks and business, take his doctrine with respect to affordable health care, take his doctrine with respect to the social safety net, and those are all moderate Republican, if not just straight up Republican policy. So why can't his political opponents see that? Why don't they see that instead of trying to see, he doesn't want to take me to go play golf? Because if they look at the policies, it would seem clear to me that he's already made overtures over and over and over again to those on the right.
Well,
there's no substitute for actually spending time with the president at Camp David or inside the White House in the environs itself. And it's not just even always a matter of policy, as it is a matter of understanding how a person is thinking and then figuring out where you can come to agreement. And in the case of this president, he hasn't had the advantage, perhaps, let's say, of a Lyndon Baines Johnson, who served for years in the House and then in the Senate and was majority leader or minority leader in the Senate and who had those long relationships. Or Richard Nixon, who had long relationships in the House and the Senate before coming to the presidency. Ronald Reagan didn't have those, and neither did Bill Clinton. But both of them were able to Bill Clinton, for instance, did something. I mean, he took David Gergen, a Republican who had worked for Ford and for Nixon, and brought him in and said, you know,
Obama has done that as well.
But this is the 21st century, and we face new and different challenges, and the volume has increased in terms of the contentiousness, and so it demands some actions.
Well, that's,
and so
that's,
on the part of this president, he's got to work for better or for worse. He has to work harder to reach out to the other side.
But let me jump in here, because I wonder, and I'm looking at a list of Republican senators who have been, and I have House members as well, highly critical of the way their own party is dealing with this particular issue. And I wonder sort of how and where you think, James Peterson, this is going to end. And we should say, I think it's October 17th, we've got a debt ceiling
this
deadline.
Issue, this
moving.
Issue being Obamacare?
Or the government shutdown?
Or the government shutdown.
All of the above.
So the toxic political climate is not subject to end or even resolve itself anytime soon, particularly looking at the possibility of a Cruz versus Clinton presidential campaign in 2016. I don't think the toxicity of our public discourse is going to resolve itself anytime soon. The government shutdown, the longer it goes on, the worse it gets. And so I think that there will be some incentives for us at least to overcome that piece. Hopefully,
right. Shorter is better.
There's a lot of incentive to keep this very, very short in terms of what it costs. Remember, we're now all of a sudden, the U.S. government is now buying retail instead of buying bulk. That's where you get that $1 billion price tag for previous shutdown. So we've got to really try to contain it. But let me just also say this about the shutdown piece. You know, let's put it in context. This government shutdown is in the context of right-wingers who want to drown government, and they have done so through the sequester. Right. They've also done that. When you look at the so-called recovery, the U.S. government has been shedding jobs during a recovery from a recession that has never happened in the history of this country. Right. Shedding jobs. So it's the sequester, the shedding of federal and public jobs already. When you think about school closings in Philadelphia and school closings in Chicago, for many municipalities and many states, this government's already been shut down. Mm. Right. And so hopefully those folk in Washington can see that this is going to cost. This is very, very costly, both politically as well as economically. And hopefully they can come to terms to avoid the sort of evolving exacerbation of what a shutdown really means.
But meanwhile, Joe Watkins, we're talking about something like 800,000 federal employees being told that they can't go work. These are real people with real jobs.
Yeah. That's right.
I was also reading that the Women, Infant, and Children program, which is a food program for poor women, could run out of money.
That's right.
Food stamps could run them a head start. I mean, we're talking about
a lot of people could be
underserved.
A large part of the work that I do outside of radio and television is with underserved communities. And I know that when these kinds of things happen, it's the poorest people who are hurt. And the same even goes with regards to the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, it's a law that was passed into law. It disproportionately serves the poor. So then the question becomes, in terms of making it work, is how do we make it work so that the poor people, the people who it's designed to serve, don't get left out and don't end up missing the opportunity that the act may afford? It's always tough to craft a bill that meets everybody's needs. There are always going to be people who don't like what's happening. In the case of Affordable Care Act,
which is no longer a bill, it's a law.
It's a law now, and unions who side with Democrats aren't terribly happy either, because some of their power has been taken away by this bill, and they get hit by that 40% excise tax on limousine.
I mean, the Cadillac tax.
Yeah,
doesn't kick until 2018.
But even so, a lot of them aren't happy. But they're still working with the president. The idea is, in government, when we are at our best is when we are figuring out that if something is law, if I've lost, if I was against something but it passed and I lost, then how do I work to make it better so that it works for Americans? And then how do we move forward? And that's
and that
where
was true
we,
for Medicare, that's, for instance, which was
yes,
fine.
But,
any entitlement. Republicans are never going to like.
You are a reasonable,
no,
reasonable
there,
thinking
there,
person.
There are lots
and
of reasonable people.
We're talking about people that there are, but we're talking about a caucus of people within the House of Representatives who have availed themselves to not be reasonable. And when you look at things like, you know, what's happening in the shutdown and who's going to be disproportionately impacted by that's people of color, that's people who are need the social safety net, that's government federal workers, right? Those people have been under attack by that same caucus. This is why you got the defund the SNAP bill. They've underfunded SNAP for the next 10 years. This is why you get them vehemently sort of protesting. This is protest politics against the Affordable Care Act. They've already targeted this government and these populations disproportionately affected by this shutdown through their policy. And so the consequence of this is why they're cheering. The consequence of the shutdown is the achievement of some of their political goals. How do you negotiate with terrorists?
You're calling them terrorists?
Yes, because they're terrorizing the American people and have been for some time. How do you negotiate with people who are prepared to shut down the government, to underfund poor people, to deny them access to health care, and the litmus test for them is their capacity, compromise.
Hold on one second. Only because I need to reintroduce you, and we have a lot of callers that want to join this very hearty conversation. Just a quick comment, Joe Watkins. You want to say something.
All I wanted to say is that one of the things that I'm asking for, and I'm asking this of our president and of all of our leaders, is to call America to its better angels. I mean, if we degenerate into finger pointing and blame over why the government's been shut down, we all lose. What we have to do is we have to regroup, and we have to lower the volume a little bit and then figure out how we move forward together.
And that's Joe Watkins. He's a Republican strategist, political commentator here in Philadelphia. Also with us, James Peterson, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University. And we are talking about our government, our politics, and the fact that there is a partial government shutdown because Republicans and Democrats, the House and the Senate, could not come to an agreement on a bill to fund the government for just the next 6 weeks. So we could be doing this all over again. Again, folks, let me see what Linda from Cherry Hill has to say. Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Nice to speak with you. I'm a mother of a 26-year-old son who recently aged out of our health care plan. Thanks to Obamacare, he had a few extra years with us on the plan. I've been counting the days until today because I've been paying COBRA now, and I can get a new plan for him for less than half what my COBRA costs. I want everyone to know that I'm one of those Americans that the Republicans are now saying this bill is unfair to. I think it's very fair. I don't want to delay it. I want it now because I'm going broke paying for COBRA.
Well, Linda,
and you know, it's just unbelievable that they're now using me, the individual American, as a ploy to close down the government.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Joe, what we heard certainly from the critics of the Affordable Care Act is that Americans don't want it. They don't like it. It's going to hurt them.
Well, beauty is, of course, in the eye of the beholder. It just depends on where you are, because the costs depend on where you may happen to find yourself. So in the state of Mississippi, for instance, for a family making $50,000, the average cost per month might be $1,096. And some
before
people there,
tax subsidies.
Which may not be helpful to some folks. But so it really depends. It, for many people, it will be a good thing. The question is not so much about the folks who are positively impacted. Like I said, it's a great thing if we can help people who have not had health insurance get health insurance. The challenge becomes for in this environment where we have high high unemployment for small business owners. I'm talking about the business owners that have 50 employees or less. For them, the challenge is, and many of them
and
are
delayed.
Even with the delay, the challenge for them. And I've been a small business owner. I've worn so many hats. I kind of understand a lot of different people. But as a small business owner, I understand. So for small business owners, they're not partisan. They're just saying to themselves, you know what? This is all I do is this business, you know, whether, you know, whatever it is they do. And for them, they're going to have to spend money. Either they're going to have to spend money to get somebody to decipher the bill for them, so a James Peterson can come in and say, tell them all the provisions of the bill. Or they'll end up, if they don't have time or the money to do that, they'll try to do some kind of fancier maneuver with the hours of their employees to jack them under 30 hours.
Which some of these companies were doing this before Affordable Care Act was even in place.
Which is true, but it'll hurt the poorest people who are hourly wage workers. And so those are some of the challenges that you get with the bill. In the early days of the bill, there'll be some confusion only because people won't know.
It's not a bill.
Right, okay. Excuse me. It's not to damn the legislation,
okay.
which is now law. It just means that there'll be some challenges. There'll be some glitches.
Let me get John from Germantown to join us. And James, I'll put this to you. John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm calling to let you guys know that I think this is exactly the way the framers intended the Constitution to work. I mean, this is called checks and balances. this is how it was originally designed, with the plan that one person or one party cannot take control of the entire country. And the fact that one party is exercising its constitutional right, the House in this case, does not mean it's racist, terrorism, or drowning the American people. All they're doing is following the Constitution the way it was designed. And as far as the last caller, who has a 26-year-old son, let him get a job.
Well, that's nice, John. Thanks Great. For calling into Radio Times.
Yeah,
go ahead, James Peterson.
I don't know
Peterson.
Exactly how he wants me to respond to that. The drowning the baby in the bathwater analogy about government, that's Grover Norquist. That's not me saying that. My comment and the analogy about terrorism is about what's the end game for these politicals who are invested in shutting the government down? And my argument is that it's for political purposes only. It doesn't serve any policy purpose here, because if you're really invested in affordable care, particularly from a compassionate conservative side where you want more people to actually get health care, then you would be invested in doing exactly what Reverend Joe Watkins is just now talking about, which is how do we massage this law? How do we make it better? How do we make it tailor it to the different populations that will face some challenges, whether economic or not? Knowledge-based challenges with the law itself. That's not what we're seeing. We're not seeing people invested in government. We're seeing people invested in politics. And I think that is what the consequences of a shutdown under these terms, I think, is what reflects the debilitating nature of the political discourse in this nation.
Right, well, and Joe, I mean, I think what we're talking about here is the politicization
yes.
of the budgetary process. I mean, normally... Yeah. Congress votes on a budget and then and actually on budget on things that they have already approved.
If things work the way they used to,
I'm not sure what the framers intended.
If they worked like they ought to work on paper, then the process would be a lot smoother than it actually is, because of the fact that human beings are involved. We do have challenges sometimes. And we do have the freedom as Americans to exercise our perspective, to have our voice heard. But at the same time, once a matter has been passed into law, it's the law and we have to all live by it. And then if we're Americans and we care about the country, we work to make it work and make it better so that more people are able to manage also, well.
I have a very wonky question for you. I mean, do you think the fact that there really aren't earmarks the way they used to be, and certainly other presidents were able to use bridges to nowhere and earmarks and other leadership in Congress.
You mean the quid pro quo?
Exactly. In order, I'll build you a bridge and you build me a highway. That kind of thing.
I think we're searching for an answer that is readily apparent. I believe that we have a small group of political leaders who are using ideology to trump their sense of the greater good of both government and the United States of America. And I think there are lots of different excuses that we can feed into that, and lots of good reasons and ways in which maybe you can make it better. So yes, maybe if we hadn't clamped down on earmarks, you could probably sway a few more people to the other side of any one particular discussion. But that doesn't go to the fundamental problem that we're confronted with here. And I'm not some big, much respect to the Constitution Center here in Philadelphia, but the framers of the Constitution didn't get everything right. Okay, they didn't get racial equality and gender equality right. And so I don't use that as the governing document in terms of how we think about politics in the 21st century. What I'm invested in is a pragmatic approach to serving and representing the American people. And I'm suggesting to your listeners that this Congress does not represent the American people.
We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Again, that's James Peterson from Lehigh University. Also with us, Joe Watkins. He's a Republican strategist and political commentator. And we have a full bank of calls here, 1-888-477-9499. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Wheaton Arts in Millville, New Jersey, presents the Festival of Fine Craft, Saturday and Sunday, October 5th and 6th, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. both days. 130 juried artists and more. Details online at wheatonarts.org.
Reading Terminal Market supports WHYY. Located at 12th and Arch Streets in Center City, the historic market has served Philadelphians for more than 120 years. The market's annual Harvest Festival is on Saturday, October 12th, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. outside on Filbert Street, featuring fall harvest foods, hay rides, live music, games, and more. Customer parking is available in garages at 12th and Filbert and 11th and Arch. More information at readingterminalmarket.org.
single-minded toughness, and the path to success.
It dawned on me how important education was to my father. It was just the most important thing ever.
Melanie Kupczynski's tough teacher father is why she became a principal violinist for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Thoughts on the importance of toughness and discipline in education next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Door to Door Organics, an online grocer that delivers food fresh from organic farmers and local producers to homes throughout the Philadelphia metro area and beyond. More about food that supports health, community, and the environment at DoorToDoorOrganics.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, having a very hearty conversation with Joe Watkins and James Peterson and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And just this little note here, the 26-year-old who is the son of Linda who called from Cherry Hill, he does have a job.
He's working.
To John
He's
from working. Germantown. So take care of that.
And there are lots of people who are working who actually don't have health insurance, and so
and lots of people who are capable of working, but in this unemployment environment, there aren't jobs available for them to get. It's not as simple as just going out and getting a job.
Let me get to Paul from looks like Levittown to join us. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you, Marty.
Good morning to you all.
I want to just ask about other winners and losers. I accept the fact that some of this vehemence about this particular law is personal vehemence directed at the president. I guess that's certainly not all of it, but it seems like it is part of it and part of the Tea Party. But there's a line in the Washington Post today, very quickly. It says, this is all about stopping a law that increases taxes on rich people and reduces subsidies to private insurers and Medicare in order to help low-income Americans buy health insurance. That's it. That's why the Republican Party will shut down government, etc. I wonder if you all could address the economic aspects, the winners and losers of this law, how that plays into this intensity of reaction to it on the Republican side. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Radio Times.
I guess,
let me just say the Affordable Care Act, I mean, it really just applies to about 15% of the population.
Right.
It doesn't really apply to most people, at least as it stands now.
But it's a paradigmatic shift in how we see the delivery of health care and what this nation's responsibility is.
It's a different delivery structure
but
than we've seen in the past.
Delivery.
But part of the challenge, I suppose, is for a lot of big companies, there won't be any real shift or change by virtue of this law. For smaller companies, for smaller businesses, they don't have all the stuff that big companies have, which are armies of lawyers and accountants and other kinds of people. This will present more challenges. And because a majority of the businesses that employ people are small businesses, this is where we could see some impact in the short term on the rate of employment. Not a huge impact, but some impact. Because people don't know, some people will be afraid. Many employers, and I speak as somebody who's been an employer, won't know. And in order to secure their bottom line, they may lay off people in the short term. So these are some of the challenges that come with it. Also, the people still aren't fully aware of the penalties, either on the individual side or on the business side,
and $95 for the first year.
I understand, and no further penalty for the individual, and then 2%. I mean, I understand all that, and I
1%.
I the first year 1%, and then the second year it goes up. But that being the case, not huge. Mm-hmm. The law is not going to go after people. They're not going to put people in jail. The IRS may take some of the money out of your refund if you haven't been participating in the system. But the big challenge becomes for these small companies, for these small businesses,
sure.
And they're not mean-spirited and they're not partisan, but they are going to feel a pinch, and that's been, I've done a lot of research on that, and so that becomes part of the challenge, sure. And that's why the need for dialogue. I mean, if you mm-hmm. talk, if the people on Capitol Hill are talking to each other, there are ways to fix things. I mean, you don't have to say, well, we didn't want the bill, so therefore, alleviate some of the challenges,
sure.
Make it easier
for
people,
which is what policymakers are supposed to do.
Supposed to do.
Right. Well, in fact, during this break, you both were talking about the fact that, picking up on your point, Joe Watkins, about the president reaching out to the other side, and there are people on the other side, it looks like, James Peterson,
who may be reasonable allies, not so much in the House, but certainly there are senators and other political leaders who the president can and I think will work with going forward. I think the caller's question in the quote from Washington Post is a fairly accurate assessment of what the challenges are, and you can see those folk who are representing business interests and those people who are not invested in the social safety net and really being more compassionate United States of America are those who are anti-Affordable Care Act. And even my colleague right here understands that it makes sense for us to bring more people into the system. You know why? Because those of us who pay for insurance, we pay for those folk who are not in the system anyway. You know, and the conversation around affordable care, there are some very simple principles here. It's not about the cost of care going down or cost of care going up. It's about, can we control or manage the rate of inflation of the cost of healthcare? It has outpaced general inflation for decades. Affordable Care Act has started to stem that flow, and these exchanges are proving that they can do so as well. And so it's about taking something that's the size of the economy of France within our own economy and making it more manageable in the future. Affordable Care Act does that. It needs to be tweaked like any piece of legislation of this size. But the question of just putting the ball away and going home doesn't make sense now that it's law.
But I sometimes wonder, as I listen to the critics, Joe, whether they're afraid that the Affordable Care Act will work or it won't work.
Well, everybody's afraid of the unknown, and this is a large entitlement. Anytime you have a new government program coming into place, people are always going to be concerned about, what does it mean for me? And that's where money is involved, because if you're at least a larger entity and you have the money to decipher what it means for you, then you can make a reasonable decision as to, you know, what to do. For the people who don't have the money to do that, it's a little bit more frightening. And for instance, it means something different for everybody. For insurers, it means more scrutiny. For doctors, it means more patients. For some doctors, in some places, they may make decisions based upon cost. We hope that they make decisions upon what's right and what's best for their patients, but some may be inclined to say, well, I'm going to do this based on cost. So, but
some doctors are already making
those
decisions.
And some were already doing that before that. There's no doubt about that. So for everybody, it's different, but figuring out what it means for me and how good it looks at the moment.
Very simple answer. What it means is we're a compassionate America, or at least we're trying to be. There are too many people in this nation for us to consider ourselves a first world modern nation who do not have affordable access to health care, and this is why this sloppy piece of legislation is one way of beginning the process of addressing that. If we want to be that America, then let's work together to make this work for the people that are here. But 30 million more people in the system, people need to understand that we were paying for some of those folk anyway, and the reason why the exchanges have to be put in place is because all these healthcare entities stand to make a lot of money by these additional folk coming in, and this is the reason why we're trying to work through some of those processes about who gets taxed and who gets to pay a little bit more and who this will become affordable for.
Let me get looks like Jim from Westchester to join us on Radio Times, and I believe we have Jim joining us. Yes, go ahead. You're
you
on the
got
air.
Me.
Okay, Jim, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a history professor, and I'm sitting here writing up a lecture on the various constitutions and elections that led up to the Nigerian Civil War of the late 60s. We know it as the Biafran War, and I'm struck by many of the similarities to what's going on in this country. I was just wondering if either of you gentlemen would like to comment on whether or not it's possible for members of Congress to be accused of treason for, example, ignoring a law that's been passed and upheld by the Supreme Court.
You used the word terrorist. You
I did,
use the word
and maybe, you know, treason, I don't think this fits the bill for that, right? And I know I'm going to get a lot of flack about that terrorist comment. What I'm suggesting is that we have people in our political system who are essentially engaged in political activity just for the effects of it. And I think that's where you get this shutdown. Why do we have this shutdown? Literally so that some politicals can go back to their gerrymandered districts and say, we shut down the U.S. government.
Well, let me toss something to you, Joe, and I'm looking at the clock here, and I heard last night that the Chamber of Commerce is getting worried, and I would assume that the Chamber representing big business or business, Wall Street, financial firms, they cannot be happy about a government shutdown or the possibility in a couple of weeks of the government defaulting on its debt. At some point, they're going to have to come in and start,
You would be correct on that, Marty. I mean, the specter of defaulting it could be catastrophic for the United States and also
and
for the world. Right. The world. It could have a domino effect around the world, and so we don't want to go there for sure. I think the what happened last night is not good for the financial markets. Of course, they're already jittery, and now they're going to remain jittery for a moment until we regain our balance. But the hope is for calmer minds to prevail, and likewise, if the president, along with leaders on both sides who are reasonable and who care about the country, can come together. And let me rephrase that. I think everybody, most of the people in Congress care deeply about the country. The challenge becomes that sometimes political self-interest gets in the way, and so they end up acting on their own behalf more so than on behalf of the country. And that could be solved by term limits, I think, in part. But we don't have that.
I mean,
and we don't have that yet, so that's just a dream. But I think if the president could call together some of those leaders and really begin a dialogue. What we don't want is you never want well-intentioned legislation to have unintended consequences. You know, AFDC was legislation that came out during the Great Society days of President Lyndon Johnson, meant to help poor families, the poorest families, and a very well-intentioned piece of legislation. Of course, the consequences of the legislation were unintended. I mean, mm-hmm. it's helped in part to create lots of single-parent households, sadly, around the country. It's helped people, but it's also had an impact on family life in the country. So dialogue helps you overcome that. If you're talking, if both sides are talking, if you're constantly, like in business, you're making the product better, if you can figure out a way to make it work better, then everybody wins.
We're going to have to debate the impact of AFDC
on the snippet. Nothing is all good or all bad.
Let me tell something to you, James Peterson, which is, and I have a list here, this is actually from Think Progress, but nonetheless, list of GOP members that the president perhaps could probably sit down with.
Sure.
Tom Cole, Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. Peter King of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Even Paul Ryan is quoted here saying, we have to stay on the right side of public opinion. Shutting down the government puts us on the wrong side. The fight is on the debt limit, which of course is in a couple of weeks. But it seems, are these the potentially reasonable people that could sit down?
They are, but this president, one, has decided that he's not going to negotiate on matters of policy that should be foregone conclusions based upon the structural process of the way that American government is supposed to work. And so while he did negotiate on the debt ceiling in 2011, he is not going to do that here. He's not going to allow Republicans to try to interject different policy initiatives based on special interests.
I agree. That
way of doing politics is disgusting to the American people, number one. But the president has realized he doesn't have to negotiate with them on that. The debt ceiling is not about someone saying, hey, we're not going to pay our bills until you get these little policy special interest things sorted on our side. That's not what the debt ceiling is for. Historically, it has not been that way. And it looks like the president's not going to negotiate on that.
What I'm saying is very different. What I'm saying is that it's not about the president negotiating with Republicans. I'd love to see him have a really great working dialogue with Republicans as well as Democrats.
I would love to see Republicans acknowledge the policies that are already their own.
And there are people on the president's side. I mean, remember, the folks just beat back his initial choice to chair the Fed. I'd like to see him have a great relationship with some Democrats as well, so that we can get some things done here. I think that we all lose if we're mired in partisan politics and partisan bickering. If it's finger pointing, people have made mistakes. People have done things badly, and the end result has been that now we are where we are with a partial government shutdown and heading toward this challenge having to do with the debt ceiling in a few weeks.
But can just clarify a couple things.
Ahead,
progressives. Argue to have Lawrence Summers removed as a candidate, because when you look at the work that Lawrence Summers, the role that he played in deregulation, the role that he played in the actual financial crises that we've had of recent memory, was one that suggested to progressives that he should not be in charge of the Fed. That was a very reasonable, when you look at his, just Larry Summers' policies, a very reasonable political argument. Look at how they did that as well, right? They lobbied and they went after the president. They went into the public. They went on network news and they made it a public part of the process. And actually, they represent the way a lot of people, even some Tea Partiers, think about people who have been in charge of the Fed. Mm. So that is the way politics is supposed to work. This is not what's going on right now with the shutdown or what they're trying to make go on with the debt seal, the debt limits ceiling, which they're trying to now sort of tie these two things together to try to come up with some kind of solution. This is, you know, that's again terroristic politics versus like politics is about discussion and discourse and ideas.
But Joel, I'm again looking at the clock here, but so how do you turn down the temperature? I mean, we've had a very
I think the president is an ideal person to turn it down is because there have been a lot of mean darts hurled his way. And for him to be able to say, you know what, you know, people have said some mean things to me, but at the end of the day, I'm the president of the United States, I'm the commander in chief, and let me be the one to turn down the volume and to say this is what we have to do. I'm
going to come on over to my house.
Absolutely.
And let's talk.
Let's get some people, especially the ones that have already indicated that they care not about shutting. They care about keeping the government open and making sure that we function and that we retain our place in the world. Let's talk to those folks and start a dialogue and move forward from here. Let's forget. Get whatever's happened in the past, and let's move forward from this point forward for the sake of the United States of America. Because let me tell you, if we don't raise the debt ceiling in a few weeks, we have a problem. If we default in our loans, we have a huge problem, and the world has a problem. We already have a problem with this partial government shutdown. This needs to end quickly. But
and it's a partial government shutdown in the context of the sequester, in the context of the federal government shedding hundreds of thousands of jobs in the exact moment where we need the federal government to be adding jobs. So these things will stack in terms of how they exacerbate each other. The president will reach out to reasonable people. He will communicate with reasonable people on the other side. But how does he communicate with Ted Cruz? How does he communicate with Mike Lee? How does he communicate with lawmakers who are only invested in politics for show and for their own gerrymandered districts or their own presidential aspirations and not invested in politics on behalf of furthering causes for American people?
Well, we have to end on that note. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. It's been great fun, and it's good
always
to have you two
to
together
so
in the studio together. James
yes.
Peterson, Director of Africana Studies and Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University. Joe Watkins is a Republican strategist and political commentator, worked in the White House of George Herbert Walker Bush. He serves as pastor for Philadelphia's Christ Evangelical Lutheran Church, and if that weren't enough, he's also the receiver for the Chester Upland School District. We'll have to have you back to talk about that.
Glad to.
whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. And I posted something on our Facebook page earlier today. You can go there and join that conversation. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And stay with us. We'll be right back.